Right, so we come to Anthony Burgess's Tremor of Intent. And we're very much into the 1960s with this, a novel that's published in the mid-60s and has a lot of resonance, I suppose, in that decade, and particularly the kind of mid-60s, exploiting certain elements of popular culture, but also, I think, having a very distinctive Burgessian feel to it. And Burgess, I think, I would say this, wouldn't I? But I think Burgess is a very interesting novelist, very much worth our attention for all kinds of reasons. He fits in very well to the sense of an ending in all kinds of ways, and we'll perhaps emphasise that as we go through. So today I want to say a little bit about Burgess as a novelist, because I'm aware that for most of you, perhaps, Burgess doesn't mean very much at all, and if he does, he probably means Clockwork Orange. So I want to say something about Burgess as a novelist in order to contextualise this particular novel. Say something about the 1960s cultural context in which he's writing, to try and establish something about the kinds of texts out of which this novel emerges. And that will help us to home in on the idea of the spy novel genre, which will then lead us to say something about the key characteristics of this novel. There's a picture of Burgess taken in the, I think probably 1970s, with a pile of his books, and it just kind of illustrates the prolific nature of his authorship. So if you think about Burgess as a novelist, he's born in 1917, but he doesn't start to publish novels until the 1950s. He's written a couple before then, but they're not published, and so it's not until 1956 that he actually publishes a first novel, which is the first of his Malayan trilogy. So therefore, he's in his very late 30s before he establishes himself as a novelist. And after that, things go very quickly. Just to say a little bit about his career then. He's born in Manchester in 1917. He goes to Manchester University, but then the war breaks out, rather inconveniently, and he ends up not really as a combatant, but in the education corps in the war. He's posted to Gibraltar. He comes out of the war, he has a short career as a school teacher, and then he gets a job in Malaysia, or Malaya as it then was, still part of the empire, still a few years off independence. And he's an education officer over there, and he also works in a teacher training college. So the three novels that he writes, which are collected as a Malayan trilogy, you'll sometimes see a title called The Long Day Wanes, which is a Tennyson quotation. That's the three novels that he wrote in the late 50s about a character who's not dissimilar to him, and that character's encounters with various aspects of Malayan life in the 1950s, leading up to Malayan independence. So at the end of that, he then went off to Brunei to do a similar kind of job. And then there's a very curious incident, and the accounts of this vary. And one thing that you find with Burgess when you get to know him is that he likes to embellish stories. He's a good storyteller, and he likes to tell a good story rather than perhaps the true story. So what happens at the end of his colonial service is that one afternoon he just kind of lies down in the classroom. And, you know, something that, that most of us have felt the desire to do, but resist. But he didn't resist. He lay down in the classroom. You know, there was a lot of fuss, obviously. You know, they thought he'd had some kind of stroke, some sort of attack. The story he tells is that he's then examined, and the diagnosis is that he's got a terminal illness. You know, some kind of brain thing that he's going to kill him within a year. So he goes back home to England. So having had that kind of expat experience, you know, that does actually kind of play out in a lot of his writing after that. He comes home, allegedly with a year to live. So what he does is he thinks, well, I'd better earn some money, because his wife at the time is an alcoholic and is unlikely to hold down a steady job as a result. So he thinks he needs to make some money in order to provide for his widow, as you know, as she is going to be. He can't get a regular job with the condition that he's in, so he decides he's going to write. He writes 5 novels in a year. What I've called the terminal year. Not the terminal year, because he's got a long career ahead of him, but you know, he says that he felt it was his terminal year. So he writes 5 novels, which get published in the next couple of years. There's a great story about one of them. Because he'd written 5 novels, he didn't want to kind of flood the market with novels under his name. So he wrote one of them under a pseudonym. Inside Mr. Enderby was written under the pseudonym Joseph Kell, published in 1963. At the time, Burgess was also doing reviews for the Yorkshire Post. And they sent him this new book by this bloke called Joseph Kell. So he reviewed it. He said it was okay in parts. You know, there were bits of it that he didn't like, and you know, he gave it a kind of mediocre review. And they found out, and they sacked him as a result. Well, I thought it was quite a noble thing to do, actually, just to appraise it in a fairly detached way, you know, and say what you think of it. So by this time, of course, it becomes clear that he isn't dead, and he's unlikely to die. And that story, you know, gets repeated over the years and elaborated upon. And apparently he was examined by Sir Roger Bannister, who was famous at the time for being the first man to run a mile in 4 minutes, and who was a surgeon. And, you know, that kind of pieces away. So after that, then, he's got a very long career, and a very prolific career. So he dies in his mid-70s in 1993, and between this late arrival as a novelist in the late 50s and his death in 1993, he writes about 40 novels, various other works of criticism, of literary history, of biography. He also writes a huge amount of journalism, reviews and so on. He writes quite a lot of other sorts of social commentary, that kind of thing. He writes travel books. He writes a book about tea. He writes a book about bed. So, you know, there's just an enormous amount of stuff. Apart from that, of course, Burgess thought that actually he was a better musician than he was a novelist. Other people don't agree. And so a lot of the time he's writing music too. He wrote several symphonies, he wrote some guitar quartets, he wrote various other pieces of music. One quite interesting thing for the Burgess scholar that's happening now is that the Burgess Foundation is discovering more and more unpublished stuff. So the thought is that there's probably about half as much again from what is already an enormous legacy of work, there's probably a load more that remains unpublished. These are things like short stories, film scripts. I'll mention one of the film scripts in a minute. Various other items. There's a couple of novels that didn't make it, and so on. So, fantastically prolific. That's the point I'm making here. Some other high points in his career. The Enderby novels go through the 60s, 70s. Enderby was a character, a bit like Sherlock Holmes, had to be revived. He killed him off in the third Enderby book, and then because people said, Enderby's our favourite character, he devised a way of reviving him. 1980, he published probably his most accomplished novel called Earthly Powers. This is a saga of the 20th century, really. Interesting from our point of view because in that book he rehearses once again the kind of battle between good and evil which you see in Tremor of Intent. Earthly Powers traces the rise to power of a pope and in parallel with the life of a friend of his who is a novelist. A bit like Somerset Maugham, actually. So their story more or less spans the 20th century, and they encounter all kinds of episodes within the 20th century which are very important. So, obviously, the First and Second World War, but also various events that are significant and kind of dramatise that good versus evil battle. His final full novel, it's not quite his final novel, there was a novel published posthumously, it's a novel in verse. So his final kind of standard novel, if you like, is A Dead Man in Deptford. And I mention that because it has an Elizabethan setting. It's about Christopher Marlowe, who is the eponymous dead man in Deptford. But it dramatises the last few years of his life, and in particular, Marlowe, as you probably know, was strong. Well, I think more than strongly suspected. I think it's kind of assumed now by scholars that Marlowe was some kind of spy, and so A Dead Man in Deptford is another example, if you like, of Burgess's interest in espionage and spying and that kind of field of activity. And it's a very powerful novel and interesting from the point of view of somebody who has, at that point, about a year to live. So I think, an interesting and diverse career is what we can say about Burgess. So if we think about the 1960s, when he's writing our book, Tremor of Intent, I mentioned that rather startling phrase, sexual intercourse began in 1963, the Philip Larkin poem a couple of weeks ago. And we didn't sort of explore that too much then. I want to say a little bit about that now. The 60s then, when you begin to characterise them, I think the Philip Larkin quotation is perhaps a reasonable one to start with. It's from a poem called Annus Mirabilis, Latin for miraculous year. And it mentions a couple of topical things connected with the time. It mentions what he calls the Chatterley ban. This is the ban on Lady Chatterley's Lover, the D.H. Lawrence novel, which had been forbidden to be published. And then in 1961, Penguin Books mounted a legal challenge. They published it and sort of awaited prosecution, which duly came, and they went to court and they won their case. And it's a significant moment in literature because what it meant after that was that basically if you wanted to publish anything with a lot of obscenities in it, then you could, because that case had been won. Of course, the other thing that that Larkin mentions in this poem is the Beatles' first LP. I'm conscious that this is ancient language to people, so it stands for long player. So it's an album, basically. This is what Larkin says. Sexual intercourse began in 1963, which was rather late for me. Between the end of the Chatterley ban and the Beatles' first LP, up to then there'd only been a sort of bargaining, a wrangle for the ring, a shame that started at 16 and spread to everything. Then all at once the quarrel sank, everyone felt the same, and every life became a brilliant breaking of the bank, a quite unlosable game. So life was never better than in 1963, just too late for me, between the end of the Chatterley ban and the Beatles' first LP. I mean, it's a slight poem, it's a fairly comic poem, and I think it you know, if you've come across Larkin before, it presents that kind of rather shabby, rather reticent, rather wry view of the world that he wanted to present to people. But nonetheless, I think it illustrates one thing, which is that particular conventions, particular moral conventions, were beginning to be dismantled. And, you know, you can see that, for example, in... I suppose the most startling example would be the number of children produced, in the phrase that would have been used at the time, out of wedlock. Before the 1960s, that would have been a terrible shaming thing. Larkin mentions shame in that poem. Whereas from about the late 60s and mid 70s onwards, becomes fairly normal. To the point we've reached now where I think I'm right in saying that more children are born to parents who are not married than to ones who are. And if it's not quite that, it's quite close. You're also talking about a period of relative prosperity, more or less full employment in the 1960s, and therefore perhaps ripe for the development of youth cultures and subcultures, because young people leaving school at 16 have got some money because they can get jobs immediately and they've got disposable income. On a darker note, it's also the time of the Cold War tensions, because you have things like the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, where we came quite close to nuclear war. And you've also got the ongoing Cold War shenanigans between the Western powers and the Soviet bloc. And you have, in the beginning of the 60s, you have the scandal of the double agents led by Kim Philby, who managed to remain undetected for a number of years at a very high position in British military intelligence, and which meant that a lot of British work was compromised. And presumably a lot of spies were killed as a result. The whole kind of spy thing is very current during the 60s. People will have read newspaper stories about people like Philby and his cohorts. I mean, one of his cohorts was actually called Burgess, no relation, but it's interesting. If you search for Burgess and spies, you'll find Burgess and McLean and Kim Philby. There's also, beginning of the 60s, there's also the Profumo affair, where the defence, or Minister for War, I think he was, Profumo, was compromised by a relationship with a prostitute, and there was Soviet involvement too, so there's a suspicion that secrets might have been leaked that way. So all of this is current at the time. As, of course, is Twiggy there in her very fetching frock. I thought that was quite a sort of representative image of the 60s. A couple of other things that are going on. Popular culture is blossoming and booming at the time. So you have growth of what we would now think of as pop music replacing the sort of dance band music that was popular up until then. And that is led really by the pirate radio stations, often based on ships offshore, so that they could be outside the jurisdiction of whatever country they were beaming their station into. And interestingly, in a kind of very pragmatic move, that led to the BBC just kind of reorganising their stations, and you know, they produced, this was 1967, I think it was, when they went to radios 1, 2, 3, 4. And Radio 1 was basically a copy of the pirate radio stations and featured lots of the DJs from those stations too. So, in other words, what that demonstrates is the popular culture becoming mainstream. You know, you can't get a more kind of establishment organisation than the BBC. The BBC is taking on this aspect of popular culture. Pop art becomes very popular. That's somebody gazing in incomprehension at Warhol's Marilyn Monroe prints there. A couple of other things that are worth mentioning, I think, for the cultural context. The end of theatrical censorship. You have, in up until the late 1960s, you have this very odd system, which goes back to the 18th century, whereby if you want to produce a play, a new play, you have to submit the text of the play to a theatrical censor. And that censor has the power to get you to omit things, or even to say, no, you can't produce this play. And, you know, it leads to some rather ludicrous exchanges. There's some quite interesting ones. If you look at Joe Orton's correspondence with the theatrical censor, you know, they do kind of trade-offs. So the censor might say, you know, well, there are too many mentions of the word bugger in this play. And so Orton is saying things like, well, I'll trade you five bloodies for a bugger then, you know, that kind of thing. And it's quite ludicrous, really. And it's often to do with obscenity and any kind of representation of sexuality. And just like the Lady Chatterley challenge in literature, it gets challenged, and finally, towards the end of the 60s, it gets abolished. And what that meant was that people could then put on plays like the musical Hair, which featured full frontal nudity for the first time on the British stage. There was also a famous, I hesitate to call it a play, kind of event called O Calcutta, which featured simulated sex and lots of nudity. And that was a result of that end of theatrical censorship. So you've got a much greater frankness in the way in which people can present sexuality and other aspects of life. And of course, until 1967, homosexuality is a criminal offence in Britain, and ceases to be so under certain conditions. It's still actually, you know, not completely decriminalised, but it's the first move towards a decriminalisation in 1967. So all of these things are kind of loosening of previous moral conventions, a shake-up of the way in which people considered what was appropriate behaviour. And that gets represented, I think, in the novels that we've come across. So this subject of espionage, it's not exactly a new subject. It's really, you could argue, goes back to Conrad. Conrad's a secret agent, if you've read that, from 1907. Secret agent is rather incompetent, actually. Tries to blow up Greenwich and doesn't do very well. But you know, the title, The Secret Agent, gives you the clue. It's so that there's a genre there from about 1907. If you remember, in Tremor of Intent, Hillier, when he's trying to jolly along the boy Alan to get him to do certain things that are going to help him out, he says, "Imagine you're in a Conrad novel." There's a tradition then from Conrad onwards. Eric Ambler, writing in the 1930s and 40s, carries this tradition on. And of course, Ian Fleming arrives with James Bond in 1953. And his novels get increasingly into the realms of fantasy, I think, as that series goes on until Fleming's death. But I suppose you could argue that the spy novel gains new traction, as it were, in the Cold War era, and probably the novel that really encapsulates that is John le Carré's The Spy Who Came Into the Cold. And there's a rather dark still from that film there. That film and that book were fantastically popular in the early 60s and set the tone, really, for the way in which a certain strand of spy fiction was going to go. Le Carré, of course, still going strong today, published a new novel last year. And it was he who introduced his character George Smiley a couple of novels before that. The Spy Who Came In From the Cold is his kind of breakthrough novel. And was one of the first novels, really, to examine the real sort of gritty, rather sordid, downbeat world of actual spies. You know, this is not the fantasy world of luxurious women and sybaritic lifestyle that you get in James Bond. This is shabby trench coats in the back streets of Berlin. So you've got different sort of strands of the spy novel getting very popular in the 1960s. And this is what Burgess is really tapping into in Tremor of Intent. As far as Burgess's career with spy novels goes, it's quite interesting that he was interested in making lots of money, and he saw that the James Bond franchise was probably a good way of making money. So he proposed a James Bond script. He wrote a James Bond script in 1968. In 1977, which was turned down. This was for The Spy Who Loved Me. And it's interesting, I think, for all kinds of reasons, because it kind of picks up on some of the more extreme elements of the James Bond franchise. If you've seen The Spy Who Loved Me, you'll know that the villain, his base is a submarine base. He's got this undersea lair, which was actually Burgess's idea, and that made it into the final film, which he didn't write. Burgess's plot for The Spy Who Loved Me begins with James Bond fighting a Chinese musical gong society and drowning one of its thugs in a tub of shark's fin soup, which he then seasons with soy sauce. He was kind of on the ball, I think. He had the right idea. I think the great sort of peril that Bond averts in Burgess's version of this film is various prominent people, unbeknownst to themselves, have had miniature atom bombs implanted under their skin. And these are timed to go off at some kind of political summit or something like that. And of course, Bond has to go in and get these out from under their skin. But Burgess and espionage goes back quite a long way. Honey for the Bears, which was one of those terminal year novels, is a comic novel with a character called Hussey, Paul Hussey, who's trapped in Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, and is suspected of being a spy. And he kind of is a spy. He's doing a rather dodgy thing for a friend of his who has died and has left him this one thing to do. And espionage does feature in several later novels. There's an element of Earthly Powers, which has a kind of spy thread running through it. Another novel called Any Old Iron, and A Dead Man in Deptford that I mentioned before. Burgess himself was not a spy. I suspect he wouldn't have been a very good spy if he tried to be. If you read, there are two biographies of Burgess, and if you read Roger Lewis's, which I don't recommend because it's an appalling piece of scholarship. No, it's not scholarship at all. It's an appalling piece of writing. He thinks Burgess was a spy and offers absolutely no evidence for it. And I think, you know, because he was such a garrulous man, I doubt whether he'd have the skill to be a spy. So he wasn't, but he was very interested in the whole kind of spy genre and the issues that it threw up. So think about Tremor of Intent, first published in the mid-60s. Andrew Biswell, who wrote the biography of Burgess that you should read, says in his introduction to this edition that it's got some kind of Ian Fleming style features, and you can think of the sexual Olympics that he has with Miss Davy. It's also got a kind of Graham Greene style examination of the human condition. Graham Greene, of course, another Catholic novelist, and another novelist that was interested in espionage and that sort of area. So in novels like Stamboul Train, for example, you get Graham Greene examining that kind of thing. And also, Biswell notes, the literary experimentation which owed something to James Joyce. Burgess owed a lot to James Joyce in all kinds of ways. And you know, there are aspects of his writing which is very close to Joyce. And if you look at part three, particularly of Tremor of Intent, then there are some Joycean elements there, I think. An eschatological spy novel. That cover that you saw illustrated there is the first American edition, which has that subtitle or strapline, an eschatological spy novel, which you would imagine is probably not going to make it fly off the shelves. But apparently Burgess approved of that. It doesn't appear on the English edition. As a subtitle. It's eschatology, then, is that branch of theology or biblical exegesis which deals with the end of things. So, you know, it's another way in which this is an appropriate novel for sense of an ending. Eschatology is about how things come to an end, you know, apocalyptic things. So it's a curious thing to put as a subtitle to a spy novel. You're not expecting, are you, if you pick up a James Bond or something like that, you're not expecting it to be dealing with apocalyptic things. Yes, there might be some villain who wants to blow up the world, you know, but you're not expecting it to be dealt with in a kind of philosophical way. You're expecting it to be dealt with in terms of action, aren't you? So the connotations of the title, I think, are interesting. About the ends of things, about how things might be resolved, and of course in terms of religious belief. And the ending of the novel, and Hillier's state at the end of the novel, is perhaps an illustration of that, you know, how it has actually taken on board some of those ideas. So the resolution that he comes to is within that context. So if we think about the structure of it, that's the illustration there is the first English edition, which is fantastically crude in terms of its iconography, I think. You know, you've got a powerful man with a rather phallic gun and a naked woman kneeling before him. And we'll see some illustrations as we go on. So if we think about the structure then, the first part, we have this, what appears to be a sort of letter, but we know that it's a letter that Hillier is not going to send. It's a first-person narrative. It begins in medias res, in the middle of the thing. So we're going to get some backstory. We're here on this ship called the Polyolbion. So Hillier explains what the situation is. He starts by saying, the position as I see it, and then goes in to explain why he's there, and fill us, the reader, in on the background. And the background is about his upbringing with Roper in the fictional town of Bradcaster, which is obviously meant to be a kind of northern town. So these two southern lads are sent off to this Catholic school in the north and have a friendship through their school and then after school as well. Hillier, I think, very clearly flags up the divergence in their views. And the divergence is to do with belief, if you like. Roper, despite their having the same sorts of experiences in the war, and despite their obviously very similar upbringings, Roper goes for a very sort of rational view of the world. Hillier goes for a view which is imbued with Catholic faith, and it's to do with the presence of evil in the world and the necessity to fight it. We also get introduced and given some detail about Roper's wife, his German wife that he marries, Brigitte. And of course, that's the kind of Achilles heel, because she's East German, and it turns out that she has been got at by the Soviet bloc, and so that's how Roper ends up being a traitor, and that's why Hillier has got to go and get him. We think, but of course, we discover later on Hillier's being double-crossed. There's also the sense of this being exploiting a kind of cliche that it's Hillier's final assignment. He's an old campaigner. He's done it all before. He's killed people, and he wants out. But this is one final job. We've all seen films with that kind of setter. He has developed a kind of self-loathing, and it's to do with the nastiness of the job that he's got to do. So he talks about his assassination of an Italian called Martinuzzi that he had to do because that's part of his job. So he says, end of Martinuzzi. Of Signora Martinuzzi and the three bambini in Trieste, also the end. But that, of course, irrelevant. The explosion of a paraffin stove in the little Casa Martinuzzi on the Via della Bellietta Vecchia and the burning alive of mother and eldest child, as well as the cat and her kittens, was just an unfortunate accident. A spy should not give hostages to fortune. That's what whoever was responsible really meant. I was sick. I vomited a belly load onto the gutter. What made my shame worse was the visit of some British lads with guitars and emetic little songs. They filled the opera house with infantile screamers. That's his only reference to rock and roll in this novel. So we've got lots of sex, we've got lots of drugs, but that's the only bit that we're rocking up. So we've got Hillier as a character who's come to the end of his tether. He's full of self-loathing, he wants it all to finish. The second part switches to a third-person omniscient narrator, and this is more like the kind of Ian Fleming-style James Bond story. We're on the ship, so of course you can't escape from the ship. It's a closed world, a bit like Graham Greene's Stamboul Train, where instead of a ship, it's a train, all the central characters are on. And we've got sort of early indications that this is going to be in that sort of James Bond style. So we have the kind of standard setup of Hillier looking at himself in the mirror, so therefore gives the author the chance to describe, you know, that he's getting on a bit, but he's still in good shape, and so on. And also we're told about the sort of brand that he has from some previous encounter with one of the enemy. He's been branded with that enemy's initial S, which is, will have some resonance from later on, I think. And in that section, part two, we get those two big set piece scenes to do with sex and gluttony. So he has his marathon session with Mr. Davy, and he's also challenged to a sort of eating competition by Mr. Theodorescu. And those are, you know, the kinds of things that you get in James Bond type novels, except that Bond, of course, would have come out on top. Hesitate to say on top, actually, when it comes to Miss Davy, but you know what I mean. That Bond would have kind of won those encounters, perhaps. The other thing that's noticeable, I think, in that chapter, or in that section, is one of the kind of little techniques that Fleming uses, which is the insistence on brand names. You know, he doesn't wear trousers, he wears Dax. You know, he doesn't have a watch, he has a, whatever it is, an Omega, you know, and so on and so forth. It's that kind of consumer culture writ large in the spy's outfit. The third part starts with a sort of Joycean stream of consciousness, which elides into an internal monologue. But we've also got some other voices coming in. Roper has written something about how he got to the position that he's in. And we get Hillier reading that and making comments on it in sort of footnote style, which is odd. And it's also interesting that Roper's voice demonstrates that kind of very factual and very rational voice. You know, he doesn't see the connotations of the things that he's doing. It's all kind of rational choice, whereas Hillier's interpretation is based on theology. But that's the most experimental it gets, I think, in that section, the beginning of part three. And then part four is really a sort of tying up of loose ends, which is something which the spy novel tends to do, I think. And the loose ends are tied up in a way which is perhaps not immediately apparent in most spy novels. You know, it's a very different conclusion. So what I'm suggesting is you've got these elements of the spy novel which obviously tie in with the way in which this popular genre developed in the 60s. But Burgess is doing something very different with it. He's a bit, I think, like Muriel Spark, if you want to make that connection, that he's examining some of the big questions of life, but doing it through, in an unusual way, doing it through, in this case, through the spy genre. Muriel Spark's doing it in the sort of comic novel terms, but they are examining the big questions. So thinking about the sort of themes and issues that emerge, this business about the battle between good and evil, you can trace it back, and this is something that Burgess often comes back to in his work, the ideas of the, well, heretic, I suppose he was, Mani, in the, I think it was the 4th century, and he was the person that was up against Augustine. At the end of one of their conversations, when he's talking about him and Roper, when they were young men, Hilaire finishes with, "Oh, what a bloody Manichaean mess life is." So, what a Manichaean view of the world suggests is that rather than a universe, we have a duoverse, if you like. So we have these two spheres of dark and light, good and evil, which are in constant combat with each other. And your role as a person is to kind of navigate your way between those. So it's this kind of doctrine that's how the world is set up. So it presupposes the existence of a kind of evil that's present always. And it's a very frequent thing. You can't get away from this great opposition, he says at the end. And he's not trying to. You know, his change of career at the end illustrates that he's not trying to. Okay. And I suppose if we think about that transformation of Hilaire at the end, it's foreshadowed all the way through the novel. When he's looking at himself in the mirror, he talks about the old Adam that he was. You know, so he's linked with original sin. And he actually mentions original sin several times. And that's one of the ways in which he parts company with Roper. The school that he and Roper attend is dedicated to St. Augustine, who is the proponent of that idea of original sin. So, you know, it's there right from the start. And from Hilaire's point of view, you know, Roper's rationalism doesn't work when you weigh up the things that he and Hilaire have seen. So things like the concentration camps, you know. So that's how Hilaire defines his position and how he kind of exerts his authority over Roper. And it's expressed, you know, sometimes in overtly religious language. So, for example, right at the end, when Hilaire is trying to explain his current position, he expresses it in those terms. He talks about the world of God and not God. We need new terms, God and not God. Salvation and damnation of equal dignity, the two sides of the coin of ultimate reality. And as for evil, they have to be liquidated. And by evil, he means the neutrals, what he calls the neutrals, what Alan calls the neutrals, people like Theodorescu, who don't subscribe to one or the other. And they're the most dangerous people. So that element of religion is perhaps a curious and surprising strand within what is otherwise a kind of action-packed spy novel with a lot of the characteristics of that kind of James Bond genre. And some of the characteristics, too, has to be said, of this kind of John le Carré style as well. He moves from the kind of James Bond style guns and secret drugs and exotic women into, you know, knocking over a lecherous Russian policeman to get into his grubby gear in order to disguise himself. You know, so that's more like John le Carré. So just to conclude then, we've got this strange mix of genres. On the one hand, it's a spy novel. On the other hand, it's a kind of philosophical treatise about some of the really big questions, the meaning of life, the nature of existence, belief, and so on. There's this mix of styles within it. Some parts are conventionally realist. Some parts go into much more experimental mode, particularly when you've got the stream of consciousness, or at least interior monologue bits in part three. The other thing that I think I've not touched on very much but is worth mentioning is the fact that the novel is replete with a lot of symbols, allusions, puzzles. There's a particular puzzle in the text about Elizabeth. You know, that's the key. Elizabeth I is a key to the coded message that he's got. And you know, the allusions are all over the place. The cruise ship is called the Polyolbion, which is, you know, they're not normally called things like that, are they? They're normally called things like the Monarch of the Seas or something. Polyolbion recalls Michael Drayton's poem from the early 17th century, which is a poem about, it's a kind of topographical poem about England, or Britain, as it's becoming at the time. So it's a kind of indication of Britishness or Englishness, and obviously at this stage, in the mid-60s, we're beginning to... The empire is diminishing rapidly, and Britain's place in the world is under question. And so this is a kind of little relic of empire, if you like, in that in the name. So there's lots of allusion, lots of intertextual stuff in there, which can lay traps for the unwary reader. So you need to be on your toes, I think, when you're reading. Okay, so I think that's all I have to say now. So thanks very much, and we'll continue in class.